Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lunar Crush Live. It is episode 114. Can you believe that, John?
You know, now that I think back, I can. We were just looking back at like Polygon when it was still Matic yesterday. Like we were looking back at some past episodes. It's been so much fun.
It's amazing. So that's what I wanted to share really quick, which was like hilarious. This was like in the bedroom, like back, like this was October 2020. Looking back, this is when Sandeep was still like in his mom's basement, and like the next one, he was like at the mall, like getting a Gucci suit or something, like walking around with the phone, which was like hilarious. So, wanted to share that. Thank you all for being here for so many episodes. You know, it's been a couple of years now, so it's been great. Hello, everyone. I'm Joe Bazzani, CEO and co-founder of Lunar Crush. As always, I'm joined my esteemed co-founder, chief product officer, and the prince of crypto Twitter, John Farjo. Thanks, my man. Just slowly, you're like behind, like, it's kind of like golf, like Katy Perry, Barack Obama, all these people are tied at number one, and then you're number two. today we're going to be joined by Anthony Scaramucci, founder at Skybridge Capital. Skybridge manages a couple of funds focused on our industry, the Skybridge Coin Fund, where they're actively managing liquid tokens. They've got the digital economy ETF, investing in crypto industry companies and digital economy companies, a digital innovation fund where it looks like they have a focus on industry infrastructure businesses or adjacent, and then, of course, the Bitcoin and Ethereum institutional grade funds. Before we bring up Anthony, a reminder, our disclaimer is always we do not take payment for our live streams. We bring passionate individuals and teams who are dedicating their careers across the cryptocurrency, NFT, and Web3 space. Please feel free to get in there and ask some questions on the Twitter thread, and we'll do our best to get to them and make sure they're all the relevant ones. Don't be lazy. And also make sure to tune in next week. We've got Marshall Hainer. He's returning to discuss the launch of Metal blockchain as the industry starts to kind of horizontally scale into application-specific freestanding blockchains. We're excited to bring him back on. One of the very few people who's been on here more than once. Nice work, Marshall. After Marshall, we have Avery Akineni, president at Vayner3. I'm sure we'll be talking about NFTs. Jeff Serlin from Sky Mavis, also founder at Axie Infinity, makers of Axie Infinity. And then one of my favorites, Travis Kling, will be joining us, founder and chief investment officer at Ikigai Asset Management. Final reminder, beta testers are going live today on V3 of the Lunar Crush API. The production launch will be in the next 2 weeks. So we're excited to see what you all build on top of the over 5 billion engagements of crypto and NFT specific social data we collect every day. So with that, let's fire up our little intro video here, and then we'll bring Mr. Scaramucci up. Hello, hello, Anthony. Welcome to the show, my man.
It's good to be on. When you were reading that statement, that means like people didn't pay you to come on the show, right? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So we don't take payment, and like we've had 100 episodes.
I'm learning, living and learning. And so and John Farjo is the crypto prince of Twitter.
Yes, I call
him crypto prince. Something like that.
I got everything right. Okay, so let me ask you guys a question because I just want to start here. This is me on the cover. I don't know if you can see that, but I'm sinking in a Bitcoin. See, this is SS Mooch. Can you guys see that?
Yeah.
And I'm sinking. Okay. I wish I owned that much Bitcoin, but there's a ton of Bitcoin on the boat. I'm going down. It's the front page of the New York Post business section. So I'm sinking. Okay. My funds are getting destroyed. And obviously there's a lot of schadenfreude there. That's getting pleasure from other people's pain. And so the Post put that in there, I guess, about 2 weeks ago. The coin fund's up 45% since the Post put that in there. My coin base position up 90% since they did that to me. And, of course, my core fund's up 11%. So I don't know. I'm not saying that's a bottom or anything like that. Who the hell knows? I want them to write another nasty article about me, though.
Right.
I'm hoping that that will lead to more share price ascendancy. But I just wanted to get your reaction. What do you think of that? You like that?
I think you got to frame that.
I mean, it had me like, I don't know if you're allowed to use the word midget anymore. You're probably not. I'll probably get canceled after this podcast, but I look like I'm very short and it's a terrible compact.
or maybe it could just be a really small boat.
Yeah, but I'm all compacted and so forth. I mean, it's terrible. But anyway, so I'm getting my, I don't know about the crypto prince, but I've been in the industry now for 2 years. I'm getting my ass kicked in the press. I had a nice life, guys. Even after I got my ass fired from the White House, I was doing just fine as a traditional finance institutional investor. But now I'm the poster boy for the crypto bear market. So I don't know. Give me some career advice. What should I do? You guys tell me.
Well, you're gonna flip my first question back to me then, because my first question was going to be, you know, financial markets, crypto markets, you know, like we're up a little bit, but far from bull market territory, right? We've got an inflation print at 9.1 last month, highest since 1981. You know, I was born in 85, so I wasn't even around. You know, believe it or not, that was almost a half century ago. We got mortgage rates that have doubled in the last 6 months, rents at all time high, cost of living across the world. So cost of business is going up. And I was going to ask you, what do you say to entrepreneurs and founders of all ages in that moment? And I was listening to a podcast that you had done about entrepreneurs not too long ago. And you kind of talked about getting beat down and how to kind of come back from that. And it's like, it seems like being an entrepreneur, being a founder, it's almost like until you get off the train, it's just going to keep happening. And then you just got to keep running.
Yeah. So a couple things. And because I'm a little older than you guys, and I do remember the 1981 inflation print. Yeah. I was in the 11th grade. I actually remember 1970 pretty well. I was six. I don't remember how bad the stock market was, but I do remember it. But Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, he failed. He got the contract from IBM, but he failed with the operating system. So he was going bankrupt. He had a rich father. He called up his rich father, Bill Gates Sr. He said, I need money. There's a group called Digital Research down the block. They've got a great operating system. They don't know about my contract with IBM. I'm going to buy that operating system, DR-DOS. I'm going to rename it MS-DOS. And that's going to be my operating system because we don't know what we're doing here. We failed with our operating system. So that happened. He went on to become the richest person. Michael Dell, who helped me get SkyBridge started, he was the original $25 million into SkyBridge, was having a problem in 1993. His stock went from 41 to 7. There was a bid on the table to buy Dell Computer from Compaq, which eventually failed and got sold into Hewlett Packard. There was a bid to buy Dell from Compaq. 1993, stock went from 41 to 7. The clunky notebooks in 1993 were catching on fire on airplanes. It's not a great look when your computer's smoking on the airplane. So his stock got hammered. I could go on and on and on if you want to hear it all. Elon Musk, he's told the story on his knees in 2008, both Tesla and SpaceX about to go bankrupt, praying for a change, getting some help from friends. There's a guy named Jeff Bezos, and maybe you guys have never heard of him, but he has a company called Amazon.com, and maybe it's just called Amazon now. It went from 116 to 6 during the March 2000 NASDAQ bubble crisis, exploded. They put a – remember the game Stratego? They had a bomb, you know, with a little – put his head in a bomb, and it said Amazon.com, the age of this internet retailer is now over, 116 to 6. I don't know. He shot himself into outer space last year in his own rocket. On the second trip up there, he took Captain Kirk with him. So you know, my point is I don't know an entrepreneur that doesn't get destroyed while they're trying to create something. You're going from zero to one. It is a very, very hard thing, which is why there's so much schadenfreude, because there's a lot of pent up, miserable people around the world. Most of these people are looking and saying, I wish I could have, I should have did that. When they see you hitting the skids, they're like, okay, that's validation for me not taking those risks. Everybody understand that?
Yeah.
So, you know, look, for me, this sucks. I'm not claiming otherwise, but this is not the worst bear market I've experienced. I was there for the 87 crash. I was there for the 2008 global financial crisis debacle. I was there in 1998 when the long-term capital management guys seized the financial system. They had $1.25 trillion on, which is the equivalent of about having $11 trillion on right now on a $4 billion balance sheet. And so this is bad. I'm not saying it's not bad. It's the worst market environment since 1970. but there's a lot of good things going on at the same time. You guys, and the Fresh Prince of crypto Twitter, you guys are onto something. Okay, the problem is you all look nuts. You dress funny. I mean, John's got some hair gel in there, and you probably get like a sponsorship from the hair gel because it's
working on it.
It's impressive hair gel, and you all look a little nuts. Okay, yeah. So the 65-year-old with the suit on is like, okay, I hate crypto or I hate Bitcoin, or Charlie Munger says it's venereal disease, then that wasn't strong enough, so he said it was the worst thing to happen to the civilization.
Right.
But you guys are onto something. You are going to change the way people transact, and there will be efficiencies, economic scale. There will be an explosion of activity and applications that will melee the traditional financial world. Because if I can do a transaction that costs me 10% more, or I can do the transaction for 0% in terms of fees, I'm going to choose the latter. Okay. And I'm just going to do that. And so you guys are on to that, and you got there ahead of me. So Joe, John, God bless you. You got there way ahead of me. But once I figured it out, I said, oh my God, this is amazing. I've got to be a part of it. But now you have to understand cycles and technological evolution. 1907, there was something called railroads. It was revolutionizing the way we transported people and goods and services around the country. The railroad stocks went like this. Then they went like that. And the country went into crisis. John Pierpont Morgan himself had to bail out the railroads. And then he ended up owning a large piece of U.S. steel because of it. That crisis created the Federal Reserve, by the way. And then you had, there were these things called horseless carriages. I don't know if you've ever driven in one, but there was a group of people that said that they will never work. That's obviously a fad. I'm sticking with my horse and my carriage. And they went up and then they went down. Then there was another thing where people were flying around, and there were statements made when they learned how to fly. Oh, there will never be any commercial applicability for that. And then since I mentioned Bill Gates, let me just bring him up again. He said in 1995, and I quote, "The internet is just a fad." It is a fad. And so then he had a reverse course and create Internet Explorer, et cetera. So we're here. We're here with fear, uncertainty, doubt, haters.
And Anthony, I mean,
artists with the ship sinking, my little midget head, you know, is thinking.
I want to touch on that because it's, I was listening to, I was at the latest Draper, Tim Draper puts this Draper Venture Summit together, and Kathy Wood was there, and she was talking about ARK, and she was talking about it in like, and I guess I hadn't kind of thought about this way, where she said, we're about as close to a VC, a public VC fund as you can have. Right. And so like, if people understand what venture does, it's like, hey, I've got 100 companies. I'm hoping, you know, I'm thinking 95 are going out of business. I'm thinking three maybe return my money to, one of them is going to double and one of them is going to do 10,000%, right? And it's like, it's not to that scale, but it's kind of in that vein of, hey, I'm going to invest in the Coinbases. I'm going to invest in the more risky assets that I can get access to. And so of course, there's going to be this higher standard deviation that's happening around that. And so why do you think that, I mean, that's, it seems like that's kind of where some of the funds are looking at. Obviously a liquid token fund would be that. And is it just people just don't understand what they're investing in, and they don't understand that, yeah, this is what you come to expect in this market, and where it's democratized, who can actually go out there and create some of these things. And that's where the risk lies, but it's also where the reward lies, and you're giving access to that.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think you're saying it better than me, but I would say on our liquid token fund, the only thing I tell people is it's well-researched, it's not an index fund. And so I don't know who's going to win. I honestly don't. But I think there will be a batch of these protocols that are part of the rail system of the future of finance, rail system of commercial activity. And so I want to be a part of that. And I may get a few wrong. You know, Amazon did way better than Yahoo. Okay. And Google did way better than AOL. So I want to be there, and I want to own everything. I can tell you this generationally. There were people that got so badly burned in March of 2000 that there's a group of people that are my contemporaries. They will never touch a technology stock. Yet over 22 years, they missed the greatest investment theme ever, because they got badly burned in March of 2000. So I don't want that to happen to these people. I'm trying to wake them up. But you mentioned my liquid token fund. I'll just spend a couple of seconds on it. You know, we avoided Terra Luna. We didn't like it. We didn't think it was structurally sound. If we were just an index fund, that was number 7 before it went down. We would have owned it and we would have hurt our customers. Number 2, we have no leverage. I'm an old man now. I recognize that I don't need leverage in this. If I'm right, if I, you know, I think Bitcoin's going to 200,000. I think it gets there over the next 2.5 to 5 years. If I'm right, why do I need leverage? That's a 10-to-1 move from where it is right now. Why do I need leverage? Okay, so I don't need the leverage. That saved our asses on the way down because of what happened just now. The third thing I would say to you is the venture capital analogy is a really sound one, because one or two of these things will go to zero. I just don't know which one. And one of these two things may go 10, 15, 20 to 1, at which point people will be looking back and saying, well, why didn't I do that? You know, Bitcoin 6 weeks ago was $17,536. It's now $22,000 or whatever. Why did I not buy a little bit of this? Why wasn't I a part of it? And I think the answer is knowledge. People don't understand it. And so by not understanding it, it creates fear. And again, I'm not saying I'm a person that understands it better than anybody else, but once I got to it and once I understood it, I said, okay, there's no way that this is not going to be a part of the future. There's no way. So,
therefore,
I have to own it. And if you don't like me for it, you want to fire me, you want to put me on a sinking boat in the New York Post, you want to tell people I'm an innocent, I'm an incapable, no problem. I'm ready to take on the fight because I know this is going to be a big part of our future and I don't want to miss it any more than I would recommend people missing Amazon when it was $6 in March of 2000.
Yeah. And they're going after you, your big target. I mean, trust me, I know a lot of people that are in this market right now. I've got people calling me that could have probably sold their business for $40, $50 million 6 months ago that are like, hey, do you just want the code? We're done. Right? Like there's that level of risk. And then there's, hey, we're trying to have exposure to this new marketplace and what's going on. You did said a couple times of once you did figure it out, then you went. Like, how did you figure out about Bitcoin? Like, who told you about Bitcoin, like, originally? And then, like, how long did it take before the light bulb went off?
It's a good question. So I'll embarrass myself by answering it. I was told by the Winklevoss twins at my conference in Las Vegas in May of 2014 about Bitcoin. And they sat down with me and they explained it to me. And I said, okay, it's interesting. I can't own it. Well, why can't you own it? Well, first of all, I wouldn't even know how to buy it. And then secondarily, it's too small. I'm an institutional investor. You guys may be right, but if you're wrong, I'll have too much egg on my face and I don't want to embarrass myself. And I said, but I'm rooting for you. I hope you're right. Didn't focus on it. It's now 2017. I'm at the White House. And I can tell you right now, it was a Wednesday. You know why I know it was a Wednesday, guys? I was only there for one Wednesday. So of course I remember the day. I got my ass fired after 11 days. Okay. So there. And we're talking about Jerome Powell. He gets named the Fed chair. Mm-hmm. And then we're talking about, quote unquote, the digitization of the U.S. dollar. And I'm like, what? Yeah, no. If we digitize the dollar, we can send the money over the blockchain. Wait, what? What's the blockchain? Oh, you know, there's a company, there's a Bitcoin and blah, blah, blah. I said, oh, this is what the Winklevosses were talking about 3 years ago. And yeah, blah, 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 blah. And I wrote down the notes and I said to myself, I got to learn about this. I was summarily fired like 5 or 6 days later. I went back to SkyBridge and I bought the website, skybridgebitcoin.com. And I went to my team. I said, listen, we got to know about this because if the U.S. government's talking about it, we have to know about it. And so that was December of 2017. And so to further embarrass myself, I didn't buy my first Bitcoin until October of 2020. Why? Number one, I had to make sure it was scaling. Okay, I know this sounds crazy to people, but $1,000 Bitcoin with 8 million wallets, 5 million wallets is not as attractive to me as a $17,000 Bitcoin with 80 million wallets. Does everybody understand that? I needed, as an institutional investor, I needed to see the arc of the movement. I needed to see the Medcast law networking effect picking up. Okay, yeah. So I had to wait. I wrote down Bitcoin's got to be at 100 million wallets. I think I bought my first Bitcoin at 80 with the watching the ascent. Number two, I had to be comfortable that I could store it somewhere safely, because if I'm buying nine figures worth of Bitcoin, I don't want to put it on a USB in my wallet, you know, on my phone. And so Fidelity convinced me that they could store it safely, cold storage, unplug from the internet, layer of insurance from Lloyd's of London. Okay, fine. We're going to do that. And then the third thing was regulation. In 2017, 18, 19, I was uncertain about the regulation. But once the IRS said that Bitcoin was intangible property, guys, I went to law school. I only learned two things. Number one, don't be a lawyer. I thought that was the most obvious thing. And then number two, property rights. Property rights in the United States are sacrosanct. They are inviolable. You're not going to lose them unless the government pays you for them. And so when the United States, through the IRS, said that Bitcoin was intangible property, good luck trying to get rid of Bitcoin in the United States. Now, you guys know this because you're smart guys. 73 or so million people own a token, according to Coinbase.
Yeah.
They're primarily single-issue voters. You don't think the politicians are coming around? Trust me, they are. I'll remind everybody that nobody wanted Uber. Everybody hated Uber. But you know who liked Uber? The people liked Uber, and they got Uber. And so we got 73 million people that own this shit. Are you allowed to curse on this? I can't. I don't
know. Yeah.
Okay.
I was about to fire one up. So.
And so you want to know what? We're going to have it. We're going to have it. And Blackstone, I'm sorry, BlackRock, forgive me, Blackstone, BlackRock just teamed up to be able to use the Aladdin risk management system of Coinbase. That's telling you guys that the institutional demand is growing up for these products. They're conservative people. They're only focused on Bitcoin. But you know this is going to happen.
Yep.
And so I don't want to be the guy that saw it and didn't have the strength or the cajones to participate, even if they're going to put me on a sinking boat on the SS Mooch as I'm heading into the water with my Bitcoin exposure.
So Anthony, you mentioned BlackRock real quick here. So, you know, coming in from, you know, the demand of your clients and saying, you know what, like all the clients are requesting access to digital assets at a very large scale. If BlackRock is doing this, what is that perspective of those clients? Like what is going through their head? Where are they mentally with looking at crypto?
They're everywhere. They're everywhere. So I have to give you the spectrum. They're where I was in 2014. You're a complete jackass and this is crazy. To wait a minute, I probably need to know about this. To, okay, I don't really understand it, but I want to buy a small piece of it because I don't want to miss it. To, oh my God, the Apple, the Isaac Newton Apple hit the person in the head. And they're like, okay, oh my God, I got to be a part of this. To my president and chief operating officer and 36-year friend who went to law school with me, Brett Messing. I mean, this guy owns, I mean, I'm the trustee on his estate. He's got too much Bitcoin. I'm just telling you, he has everything is in Bitcoin, everything. Okay, so that's the spectrum that we're on right now. Now, you know, and I know if we're right, what will happen is the bubble will move and it'll become a consensus. And let's go to Amazon. Okay, nobody owned Amazon in 2000. Everyone was embarrassed to own it. Everybody owns Amazon in 2022. It is part of the artifice of the S&P 500. It's institutionally accepted, institutionally owned. I implore you to please look at Amazon's volatility in 2000, Bitcoin-like, and look at Amazon's volatility today, stable. And so that's what's going to happen, guys. You know, and by the way, invite me back if I'm wrong. You can dunk me in the town square. You can write a nasty article about me.
Well, I think you might have to make a submarine because you'll still be going down.
I'll be under, guy, but yeah, I'll be into the earth, journey to the center of the earth. But honestly, you know, I don't care because I'm trying to provide economic historical context. Okay. Fred Smith. He's the founder of FedEx. He wrote the treatment. He presented it to the Wharton Business School professor. The guy gave him a C. He said, this is really uninspiring. We already have the U.S. postal system. This will never work. I can give you story after story of going from zero to one and what the resistance and the opposition is going from zero to one. And
it's
and
interesting
so
that
you either have the temerity to do that or you don't. And I do. And so I'm ready to do it.
I love the Amazon analogy just because, you know, back then, you know, there's no future for a company like that beyond just selling books. And by the way, we already have bookstores. Who cares? You know, and it's just, it's sort of like when you look at crypto and you look at how many different facets of crypto there are. I mean, you could say there's money, there's things that are money-like, there's dApps, there's DeFi, there's utilities, there's so many different, there's a whole bunch of sectors being formed in front of us. And it's interesting when you look at those investors at BlackRock that are like causing that demand and BlackRock has to support it. It's just interesting to think, you know, what might their perspective be? Like, what do they think about NFTs? Do they even know what a dApp is? Probably not. You know, like, and it's sort of, it's kind of interesting at that scale of money to think where their mindset is at and where they're going to be migrating to over the next few years and decades.
I mean, so could I, John, I want to just jump on that for a second, because I was at a presentation where Jeff Bezos, and I'm going to give you the date. It was July of 1999. It was at the Allen & Company Sun Valley Conference. He was making a presentation about his company. And people were saying, well, this is an internet bookseller and books are prosaic. And so why would that be worth like this amount of money? And Jeff said, listen, I'm selling books because they're easy to ship. Okay. They're roughly the same size and weight and so forth. And I'm trying to dot plot the warehouses. Okay. And once I get the warehouses dot plotted around the world, particularly here in the United States, I'm going to open the spigot. And I'm going to sell everything. And oh, by the way, I'm going to lose money for the next 10 years as I'm building this. But once I get it right, it's going to be a colossal enterprise. Well, I said, okay, this guy's a genius. I'm going to go buy the stock. Warren Buffett was the next speaker. He said, yeah, you know, Jeff's a nice young man, but this internet bookseller is ridiculously expensive. And can you believe that this bookseller is worth more than the storied Sears Roebuck, the storied retailer that has all of this real estate? Can you believe it's worth more than it's ridiculous? I'm not buying it. And so you know what I did? I ripped up my notes and I threw them in the garbage. I didn't buy it back then. I bought it later, just like Bitcoin. I didn't buy Bitcoin at 400. I bought it at 16, 17, 18,000. But my point is you got to be strong enough to know when you're wrong about something and shift gears. Second point to what you're saying about the exponential activity, we can't predict what's going to happen in this space. Suppose this was 1998, we would be talking on a phone line, not over the George Jetson teleconferencing. But let's say it was 1998, and I said to you, well, you know what? It's taking you 35 seconds for your AOL page to land, but 24 years from now, there'll be a billion people streaming 4K video on the internet, and they'll be doing trillions of dollars of transactions. So the crypto market is 1998. We don't even know where this thing is going. We don't even know what the applications are or the powers of decentralization, where they're going to lead.
John and I talk about that a lot, about it's not so much in this space of learning something new, it's unlearning what you already know. And it's kind of like the hardest thing for humans to do. It's like, we have to admit we're wrong. You know, you have to start there, and that's impossible. And then we have to start from scratch. And it's a way easier thing to just continue down a path and say, I'm right. And then kind of have like the blinders on. And it's like, that's why I think it's taking time for it to get integrated into some of the things that people are using where they don't even know they're going to use it. And I think that's what's making this a lot different. And I want to ask you a question about Bitcoin versus Amazon, because we're kind of going down that path with Amazon, American company, you know, American stock market. Like, sure, people can get exposure internationally to certain different things that are out there, you know, maybe not so much at the beginning. We now have something like Bitcoin that anyone in the world can spin a wallet up. It's not just a, you know, an American innovation. You know, we don't even know technically where it started. I mean, maybe you do. You spent those 10 days in the White House, which, by the way, is pretty funny. It's like not very often are you like, hear something in the White House, and you're like, shit, I got to call the Winklevoss twins. Like, it's like, that. It's funny.
I told them that story. I told them, I said, guys, I wish I had the strength to listen to you. I said, but the truth is, you're also a product of your environment, right? If you start out as an institutionalist, you start out as somebody that's focused on the blocking and tackling of good institutional investing, you get scared. You don't want to make a mistake or look foolish. You don't want to be painted on the sinking boat on the New York Post. You don't want to be. Okay.
So what does the next 20 years maybe look like? Like Amazon 2000 to 2022. You know, American company, everything else. Then we have Bitcoin that's kind of proliferated out. Is it a different type of path though, even though it's still this massive growth path?
Yeah, I think it's a different type of path, but I think the applications that are being built right now will start to be used. You know, so if you've got the Lightning Network growing and the use cases on the Lightning Network growing, at some point, there's going to be an El Salvadoran expat who is going to bypass Western Union to send his mom money back to El Salvador. And she's going to have a Bitcoin wallet. He's going to have a Bitcoin wallet. He's going to send the money over the Lightning Network. You know, the El Salvadoran Chamber of Commerce says there'll be $400 million a year saved in Western Union or MoneyGram fees. And remember, these people are more likely, Joe, unbanked or underbanked. And so they have to do it that way. And it's very costly. So, yeah, to me, it's going to grow in a lot of different ways. It's going to grow in a lot of unpredictable ways. You know, Starbucks, you may have a tokenized version of Starbucks stock. Maybe they'll be on the Ethereum protocol, Solana, Algorand. But there it is, a representation of your Starbucks stock in your smart wallet on your phone. And Howard Schultz, who will have returned to Starbucks as the CEO for the 40th time in 2031, and you're standing at the counter and the barista says to you, Anthony, do you want to pay with a stablecoin, a US dollar-based stablecoin? Do you want to play with your Bitcoin? Or, oh, by the way, we're doing a share purchase here at Starbucks. Would you like us to take your tokenized Starbucks stock off your phone in lieu of your latte? And you know what? We'll give you a 15% discount because we're doing this massive share repurchase at Starbucks. And we're going to give our customers the opportunity to sell us a piece of their Starbucks stock for the product that we're serving. I mean, that could happen, guys. Yeah, I mean, that is
so simple and not that far away. And
that's going to happen. So you're going to come to my restaurant, the Hunt and Fish Club in New York, and they're going to say, okay, how do you want to pay? Because, you know, we're accepting these types of currencies and let's bypass American Express or MasterCard Visa together. And I'm going to give you a 3.5% discount on your meal tonight. That's going to happen. Okay. Oh, yeah. If you don't think it's going to happen, okay. I mean, look, I have been humbled by life. I have been humbled by markets. I've been humbled by stupid decisions. So I might be wrong. I'm not going to speak to you super definitively or evangelically. I might be wrong. I don't want to talk with absolute certitude, but I see that happening. Okay. I see that as a very high probability that that's going to happen. Yeah. Because you guys know, and I know, if one price is here, or the other price is there, entrepreneurs will come in mm-hmm. and create products to allow the price to come in here. And if you don't believe me, ask Jack Dorsey. Ask Jack what Jack is doing at Block to circumvent and undercut everybody using these technologies.
And we just built a payments tool on our API and we can accept thousands of cryptocurrencies in real time. Like it took 3 weeks to build. It's not about the technology. Technology, the infrastructure is there, right? It's a matter of, can you get it out to the world? And Jack's got probably a much bigger platform than like we have, but you know what? Our customers are going to be able to pay and it's going to be super simple for them. And the technology is there. It's not that heavy of a lift to do. It's a matter of can the consumers kind of get over that fence and get there? And can they pay? And so it's like, if you just make it easy, everyone will get there.
Well, I, 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 I got a question around.
I agree. Like, nothing for me to add to that. I totally agree.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you know, the Starbucks example, I'm kind of stuck in my head on it. It's like, let's say Starbucks goes all in on crypto, right? They turn their loyalty program, their gold card rewards and all that stuff into some sort of tokenized thing. I know there's something launching, I think next week even on it. Like they turn the business into a crypto business. How does that collide with Wall Street and quarterly earnings? Like, where does the actual value end up? How does Wall Street react to the value of a company being in its token? And where does that play out?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question. And so Wall Street will be last because so much money has been made off the traditional system. Wall Street will be last. Wall Street will be critical. Wall Street will analyze it last. Wall Street will be reluctant to participate. Wall Street will be very politically focused on what's going on regulatorily in Washington. Remember, they just recently, 14 short years ago, got bailed out by Washington. So they're all very nervous about whatever Washington is saying and doing. And so they'll have a tough time evaluating that. They will be last. See what Think is doing, because he's a brilliant guy. And he's an entrepreneur. He started BlackRock. He's looking at it. And I was with him. He'll probably be super mad at me for saying this, but it's fine. Okay. I was with him in Abu Dhabi. And I was at the Four Seasons Hotel in the lobby at El Arion Island. And Larry said to me, you know, Anthony, I don't like this stuff. I don't like Bitcoin. I don't like this. I don't like that. You know, maybe a stable coin makes sense, but I don't like this stuff. And now he's doing a deal related to Bitcoin. And the point being, okay, that if you're an entrepreneur, you feed the ducks. Okay, if the ducks are coming towards you and they're coming in the pond and they want crackers, you give them crackers. If they want white bread, you give them white bread. You feed the ducks. So Larry's hearing, holy shit, there's a large group of people out there that want Bitcoin. I don't want to miss that market. How am I going to miss that market?
It's interesting too. We were just looking, like, you know, a lot of people might look at Coinbase, which is now working with BlackRock as a centralized exchange. If you go into the Coinbase app, this is not a promotion for Coinbase, by the way, they have a dApp browser in their app now. And they have a decentralized wallet that you can hook into. You can hook it into your MetaMask and all this stuff. Like, they recognize that the world is changing around them, whether they like it or not, whether they want to hold your assets or not. It's kind of an interesting topic.
I agree. But here's the thing I'm going to tell you guys, and I think you guys both know this. Sorry, your thing came on my phone. I was trying to retweet it for you.
I would love that.
Your MetaMask.
Sorry. Yeah, it just shows you I'm so old that I'm technologically inefficient. I'm trying to retweet your Lunar Crush thing.
Yeah, take your time. You can take a 20-second pause to make that happen.
But I'm just saying, like, I've seen the movie so many times in my life. This movie that we're playing right now, I have seen the movie. New idea, doubters and skeptics, okay? Erbitux, I don't know if you guys even know what that is, but Sam Waxall was at ImClone. He ended up going to jail because he had insider trading issue with Martha Stewart. But him and his brother figured out that they could create this chemotherapeutic product that could slow down cancerous growth, particularly in breast cancer. Very slow start, and now everybody's using it. The phone, the car, the plane, the internet. It all happened in the same sort of way. What is this? I don't need a web page. That's what the Fortune 500 said when the internet started. Why would I need a web page? Okay, there's a very famous story. Jerry Yang, 22 years old, he finally gets the appointment with the two Pac Bell executives. He leaves Stanford University in his little car. He drives to San Francisco. He's got a clunky laptop. He opens it up. He says, guys, let me show you this. What's your favorite pizzeria? And he types it in. He says, okay, you see, I've invented this logarithmic search engine over this thing called the internet, invented by DARPA, and I can get you the phone number and the address just by typing it in here. and do you want to buy this from me? I mean, I'm calling it Yahoo because I'm a young kid. It's a fun name. Do you want to buy this from me? And the two-pack Bell guy said, get the hell out of our office. What are you talking about? We chop down 4 million trees. We churn the trees into paper pulp. We dye the paper yellow, and we ship 4-pound books to our clients. And we sell advertising in that. And by the way, we've been doing that for 95 years. We're not going to buy your clunky logarithmic search engine, bizarrely called Yahoo. Get the hell out of our office. So the movie is being played over and over and over again. It's just in different genres. And that's where we are right now.
And why do you think, like, it's the same type of thing about people are worried about, like, jobs. They're like, oh, you know, we're going to get rid of this subsector of jobs and we're not going to have new jobs. It's like, well, no one really thought that, like, even podcaster was a job that long ago, or like influencer, or there's so many jobs that are out there today. Or, like, you know, it's like, hey, my, like, I create animated, you know, faces, filters for Snapchat. That was not a job, you know, but now there's a lot of those designers and people out there. And it's like you're saying, this movie keeps playing over and over and over again. And we have this moment in time here where, you know, a lot of the entrepreneurs I know that are under 25 or 28 years old, like, the regulations in some place like Singapore, or what they're kind of doing in Portugal or like El Salvador, it's like, this seems like a friendlier environment for an entrepreneur to go. And the movie's playing over and over and over again. And, you know, you've got regulators that, you know, I'm hoping this time, you know, cause, you know, I guess the double-edged sword of having to campaign every, you know, 14 months now, whatever the cycle is that you do have to go back out and talk to the people and figure out what they want a little bit, but are they going to get the message this next time and kind of figure it out? Because it does actually feel like for the first time where entrepreneurs are like, you know what, you'd never think like 25 years ago, it's like the having a US passport was like a piece of gold, right? But now you might say like, hey, I'm going to go, it's funny, I use gold, I should say piece of, now it's a piece of Bitcoin, but it's a Bitcoin to say, I'm going to go move to Portugal and I don't need to be in the US. Is that something that can happen?
It's very good. And obviously, you know, I don't know the answer, so I can only speculate with you, Joe. You know, Here's what I would say to you is the good news about those election cycles that you just talked about is they're screwed. So let me give you a Nash game theory analysis of the situation. Okay, let's say I'm a politician. I'm now running against somebody. I turn to my political consultant and I say, so how should I view crypto? And what is my political consultant going to say? You better be positive on crypto, because if your opponent is positive on crypto, there are 73 million people that own crypto. And by the way, they may be single issue voters. There will be a Wall Street Journal article. Yes, there are single issue voters on gun control, on abortion rights, on gay marriage, single issue voters. But most people vote with their wallets, Joe. Mm-hmm. And if they own crypto, they're going to want the politician to be pro favorable regulation towards crypto. And so to me, it's like a Nash game theory. The boxes are lining up where the politician has no choice but to support it. Because if there's 73 million people that own it, what are you going to do? Not support it? And you're going to turn off those 73? Remember, guys, these are marketing competitions.
Yeah.
Okay, these are principleless, cynical jerk-offs. Okay, you know that. I mean, come on, I was there. I know what they're like. They're going to do what is politically expedient for them to win elections. So I'm not worried about it. They're screwed. You guys know what a decentralized autonomous organization is. The 73 million people represent a decentralized lobbying organization. They are going to call the White House, going to call the Senate, call the House of Representatives, say, hey, what are you doing to my crypto? And those politicians are going to hang up the phone and say, hey, can you tell Gary Gensler to shut up and let's put some regulation in place where these people are happy?
Yeah, because we do. There does need to be some clarity at some point here, because you do have a lot of entrepreneurs that are looking and saying it's still the uncertainty is what keeps them away. And so they're either a little nervous to do something, or the barrier to entry is too high because of the legal cost, where it's like, it's almost gone backwards, where it's like, hey, I can start a business on Shopify and sell sandals you know, for a total of $80 to get started. But it's like, do we need another sandal company, you know, in America? It's like, no, we need another Google. We need, you know, another Amazon. We want that to be started here. And if we're creating an environment that's not competitive and we're not unlearning what we knew before, and like you said, pivoting yourself and saying, hey, I want to stay competitive, then we're screwed.
You're saying it better than me. So again, I don't want to add anything. Yeah. I don't want the United States to lose its mantle of financial services leadership. So I'm hoping that we get there. But these people always get dragged, Joe. Okay, nobody wanted Uber. No mayor, no city council member, no executive in the public sector. Nobody wanted Uber. Just give me a headache with the Uber thing. But you know who wanted Uber? Were the people. The people wanted Uber. And so the people in pluralistic Western democratic societies, usually they're going to get it. They're going to get what they want here. I do believe that.
How, you know, the people want it, but they also want trust. You know, I'm sitting here thinking through our last, I don't know, I guess it's 8 months at this point since, or something like that, since Bitcoin was at its high and, you know, everything was rosy, right? Everything was great. And then all of a sudden, you know, the last several months we've gone from Terra, not just Terra as an isolated thing, but, you know, Terra tanking Bitcoin as well. They had a ton of Bitcoin that they were selling on the market. We have Voyager, we have Celsius, we have 3AC. I'm sure I'm missing about another 10 things that have gone wrong here, but we have a, you know, the people want this and they're lacking that trust right now. And I know we have our angle of like measuring community activity and trying to justify like, well, is it real? But like, how does that community, I guess my question is like, how do they start to feel trust again? Like what needs to happen in this space? It seems like a critical piece right now.
Yeah. Well, again, I agree. And if you're a Met fan or a Nationals fan, Terra Luna, they've got a billboard in the left field wall at the Nat Stadium, and they've got all the seats behind home plate. And so, I mean, you're looking at that, it almost looks like a tombstone at this point, you know. And I will say this to you, and I mentioned it, you know, we didn't ever bought it. And, you know, but yet if you were indexing, you would have owned it because of the size of it. But it wasn't just Terra Luna. You know, if Bernie Madoff, the Ponzi schemer, and John Merriweather, who seized the 1998 credit markets, if Bernie Madoff and John Merriweather got together and had a baby, they would have named it Three Arrows. Okay, because it was one part Ponzi scheme, one part fraud. And they blew up, and that caused a cascade of selling of Bitcoin as well. Okay, Celsius seized. Voyager seized. We can go on and on. BlockFi seized. And so what basically happened is these things were not structured properly with the right capital requirements to create the yield strategies. So it wasn't just the structurally inappropriate Terra Luna. It was over leverage in the system and borrowings that were mismatched and people prop trading with customers' accounts where they lost money. Too much leverage in the system, and then there was fraud. So you had the trifecta. Remember, guys, there are no new mistakes on Wall Street. I've been around long enough to see this in the fixed income markets, to see it in the equity markets, to see it in NASDAQ Web 1, March of 2000. What you're watching happen right now has all happened before. It's just now happening in crypto. So the good news about where we are right now, it happened. And it imploded the system and it washed out a lot of the weak players. Remember what I said when I started this podcast with you, I'm unlevered. So yes, I got damaged, but I'm unlevered. So if I own 500 Bitcoin when this thing started, okay, and it went from 60 to 20 or whatever the numbers are, I still own 500 Bitcoin. I didn't get flushed out of my Bitcoin because I was borrowing on top of it. You see what I mean? So I'm telling people, please don't lever these things. You got enough juice in these things. If we're right, it's going 10, 20 to 1. You don't need leverage. Just get invested. Stay calm. Don't look at it every 5 minutes. Everybody is a long-term investor, Joe and John, until they have short-term losses. Mm-hmm. Your short-term losses, they flip out and they get pissed. I was at this event last night. Okay, this woman owned Bitcoin, and she was a very nice lady. She was literally in her 60s, or I think her son talked her into it. And I was speaking at the event, and she was pissed. And I looked at her. I said, "How many Bitcoins? I own 3 Bitcoin. Where did you buy the Bitcoin?" "I bought the Bitcoin at 40,000, and I'm now pissed. It's 22 or 23,000." I said, "Yes." I said, "But when did you buy the Bitcoin?" "Whatever it was, you know, 2-3 months ago." I said, "But how long were you expecting to hold the Bitcoin?" "Oh no, my son told me to hold it for 5 years." I said, "Okay, but you have it. You still have the same amount of Bitcoin. And yes, the dollars are moving around, but you shouldn't be looking at it every 5 minutes. Why don't we revisit it in 2 years, 3 years? Well, what if it goes to zero by then?" "Well, aren't you sized in it appropriately? Where if it does go to zero, let's say Joe Vez, John Farjo, Anthony Scaramucci, they were all wrong. And Bitcoin is now at zero. Okay, be sized appropriately so you don't have a permanent capital loss to your overall life. But if we're right, also have some money in the game so that if this thing does what we think it's going to do to the world, you're going to be part of it."
I think that's one of the challenges with a lot of people is that proper risk allocation. They're overinvested in very risky assets. I'm not talking Bitcoin. I'm talking like coin number 3000 by market cap. There's a lot of people way overinvested and don't even have enough money to average down because they thought it was going to moon and they thought they'd be a millionaire tomorrow. And when that didn't happen, then they get pissed. So it seems like that seems to be repeating a lot in every rally in crypto or every 100%. Time it falls. Yeah.
But again, that description, what you just said has been true for ages. That was true in the 1960s when IBM was a hot technology stock, what you just said. That was true in the 1980s when Microsoft went public and that was a hot technology stock in 1986. That was true in the 1990s when Netscape went public and it was hot, right? Remember, Google traded down. Facebook traded down. So if you're going to manage it minute to minute, yeah, you're going to be wiped out. You know, one of my buddies has lost 50% on Facebook in the last 6 months. "What are you doing with your Facebook?" "You know, I don't really care. I bought it on the IPO. These guys are very, very smart guys. They have a change in their business right now. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't really care." One of the proudest things of my life as an investor is I have tax lots in Microsoft from 1991. And because I bought it, I was 27 years old. I bought Microsoft. Now, full confession, I misplaced the goddamn statements and they were getting mailed to the wrong house. Okay. So I didn't even know I had the goddamn thing. Okay. Just making full confession. Okay.
Yeah.
But now I'm now looking at it. I'm like, this is fantastic. But you know what? It flatlined in the bomber years. Now, there's a reason why the best performing accounts at Charles Schwab are the dead people, because they don't look at the statements.
Yeah. There's a reason they love that.
Love that.
If you imagine you bought Bitcoin and you didn't see the 2017 crash and you missed the 2020 pandemic debacle and you missed the $69,000 blow off top and you bought it at like 2000, it's now 23,000 and you opened up the statement, you're very happy. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, there's a reason.
I'm sitting on Microsoft from 1991.
Yeah.
In a family trust. And I would have sold that goddamn stock. Okay, during the bomber years when it was flatlining. And I'm like, okay, well, duh, I didn't know it was there.
There's a reason that most of America's wealth is held in retirement accounts and insurance products is because they can't touch it.
It's smart. Sometimes right. It's better.
Do you think what we just kind of went through here in crypto is similar to the 2008 moment with capital requirements? And I mean, the one good thing I see out of Terra from like a structural standpoint is the only people that got burned directly by Terra were the people that were in it, right? And it's not like 2008 where it's like, hey, you know, if that happened today, it'd be a little bit different. At least like they got their money back. But it's like, hey, like the taxpayers bail out, you know, have to bail out AIG and AIG gets to pick the winners, right? And so we've got some firms that go down, some ones that don't go down. you know, based on some decisions there, and the taxpayers are the ones that have to bail that out, you know, and it's like they structured a little bit differently with lending there versus a handout, like I think they would probably do today. Mm-hmm. But I mean, is at least that a better structure?
Yeah, no,
where it's a direct, it's, you know,
I think that's it. Imagine $1.5 to $2 trillion getting wiped out of the central banking system and the freak out that would have happened. But because this is decentralized, it hit the people that owned it, but it didn't blow up and contage the entire system. Now, the only thing I would slightly disagree with you on, Joe, is that Terra Luna hurt me. I didn't own any Terra Luna, but I owned a lot of Bitcoin. And so I got hit by the border, you know, getting hurt. You see what I mean? So they did have ancillary negative consequences for the rest of the system. But so what? I'm not levered. Like I told that woman last night, you still own your Bitcoin. If you're measuring it today versus where it was in November, you can be sad, or you can stop doing that and measure it off of where you think it's going to be 5 years from now. So let me say this to you, and I want you to answer this question, both of you. I have a statement in my hand right now. It's from January 1st, 2029. So it's roughly 7 years from now. And I open it up, and my Bitcoin price is $300,000. Okay? So it's January 1st, 2029. It says $300,000. Are you caring if I bought the Bitcoin at 69? And you're my client. Are you caring if I bought it at 69, 24, 44? Or are you a happy camper the day that you open up that statement on January 1st, 2029? Or you're really fretting, well, it was 69, now it's 24, let's jump out the window.
My perspective on that is like, if you have $300,000 Bitcoin and we're that far along, we're talking United States here. If we're talking United States, you're probably talking like 300 million people probably own a piece of it. And they may not even know they do. If you look at that $300,000 price, there's a couple things in the background that have probably happened. For one, there's probably already been supply inflation to the US dollar that we can't even imagine by then. So you're so excited to hold on to that Bitcoin, and you're probably not even measuring it in the value of dollars anymore. You're looking at it at sats. You're looking at it satoshis. And the fact that you own even a whole one is a huge deal. So if you own multiple, that's probably, I think, that if we're just talking mindset, your mindset is in stacking sats versus stacking US dollars.
Yes.
That by that point, you know, it's sort of like, you know, it's kind of like looking at a house that was like $300,000 10 years ago, and now it's a million. Did your house really go up $700,000, or did the dollar get weaker? Is it like, are you that magical of a real estate investor that you just picked so well? I don't think so. I think it's more like the money. It sucks.
You're making a very good point. And that's like what my friend Mike Novogratz says, you know, geez, if it's $300,000 a coin, maybe we're in Armageddon with the rest of the fiat system. And we have to hope that what happens is, as the fiat system is restructuring itself and this is growing, we don't have an implosion. I'm not saying we will or we won't. I'm hoping that we won't, because I'm hoping it'll be gradual. But I can tell you that what we're doing doesn't feel sustainable to me. And I can just take you back 13 years ago, the budget deficit was $7 trillion. We went from George Washington to George W. Bush, $7 trillion. And now we're at $30 trillion. So we did 13 years. We added $23 trillion of debt in 13 years. Now, maybe that's sustainable. I don't know. There are modern monetary theorists that say that it is sustainable. I hope they're right, frankly, but it doesn't feel like it's sustainable. But the other thing I can prove to you as a trained economist is that it hurt the middle class and it hurt the underprivileged, because those numbers you just gave me, John, on the house, now that house is not longer affordable to that factory worker.
Right. Okay?
Because the assets went up, but this guy's pay or this woman's pay, it got devalued. So you gave me $100 for my pay, and now I have $90 of purchasing power this year versus last year. How am I going to catch up? Calvin Klein Calvin Klein bought his house in 87 out here in the Hamptons, spent $3.7 million on the house, sold it last year for $85 million. Okay, because he had the house and it appreciated alongside of the depreciation of the currency. I got it. But the hourly worker cannot catch up. He's mad. He's not going to take the vaccine. He's not going to support the establishment. He's going to stick a finger in the eye of the political, medical, and business establishment. And he's coming for your house with a pitchfork and a tiki torch because he's mad and he doesn't like what you're doing. He would like to live in an aspirational society where what you're paying him holds its value so he can save it properly to help his family or her family.
You know, through all that uncertainty that you just mentioned, in I think the year was 2027, you said, if that lady you talked to last night is still holds, it's so she's so peacefully still just holding her 3 Bitcoin. There's no uncertainty in that. You know, who knows what happens to Bitcoin between now and then, other than demand seems to be going up. But it's like, it just seems so easy to just sit and hold. It just seems so like complicated to stay out of it.
I mean, a lot of the people that we know, I mean, they've moved their net worth, you know, into 90 to 95% crypto, and then they just kind of move back into fiat when they need it. And, you know, it's just those people are just kind of ahead of the curve with the way that they want to live in this kind of like sovereign individual type way. But I mean, I think the narrative, we got ahead of the skis a little bit on the, you know, there's 21 million Bitcoin out there. And, you know, looking at the market today, looking at BlackRock coming in with access to trillions of dollars, which like they're basically just an indice at this point, but it's like looking at that and saying, hey, there's still only this many Bitcoin out there. And this is the thing that's the furthest ahead out of everything else that's out there. You're telling me that, you know, with 8 billion people on the planet and the amount of investors that are going to be out there and this next generation, this Cash App generation that's coming up, that they're really going to want all of these dollars, or are they going to want this other thing? You know, they're going to go to university and college. They're going to learn a little bit about finance. They're learning about this stuff way earlier. I mean, Johnson's launching like dApps and NFT marketplaces or whatever, and he's not even 15. Like, or maybe he's not 15, but it's like that's the next generation that's coming up. And it's like if you're ignoring that completely, you know, and you're not having some exposure, and it's like, you know, I think it was like Howard Lindzen that was talking about this before, of like, you don't need the same amount of exposure to have the same upside. You know, you put 2 to 3% in, and like you're saying, Anthony, it's like that has a 20-30x. That's, you know, why wouldn't you take that exposure? Sometimes it seems like they're, by coming over to the quote unquote, we maybe call it dark side, they're just admitting that maybe their other business and their other clients that aren't, you know, that they're not paying attention to them. So I want to ask you, like, what's coming in the next 60-90 days for SkyBridge? Like, what are you guys like working on right now where you're saying, hey, we just have all this stuff that happened in the market, maybe you've kind of reworked the teams, you've got this new strategy or whatever it may be, like what's right in front of you?
I mean, listen, I'm managing the reduction in assets to the best of my capability, you know, because obviously the asset prices went down, but again, we're on levers, so I'm very comfortable with where we are. Mm-hmm. I started an NFT company called Flatter. Why did I call it Flatter? Well, hopefully we're going to democratize and make the society flatter, but it's a double entendre on the word. When you have an NFT that's a collectible, you can gift it to somebody. You're flattering somebody with the NFT. You see what I mean? Yep. So we're going to launch a game on Flatter, hopefully early fall, which I think will be a very exciting game. And it's going to come at a low price point from an NFT collectability point of view. And I think it'll be a fun game for people. We're raising a digital venture fund. I'm probably not allowed to talk about that publicly, so I'll just say that we're raising a fund. It's been reported in the paper. Our coin fund, we're going to go out there and grow it. We're going to do our conference in September, the 12th to the 14th at the Javits Center, the SALT conference. We're doing one in Singapore in November with the Singapore Monetary Authority. And then we're doing another one in March of next year, late February, early March in Abu Dhabi. So we'll have 4 conferences. And then, of course, we'll have the Mega Crypto Bahamas conference with FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried next April. So I'm excited about the next year. And that doesn't mean that there's not going to be market volatility and uncertainty and wars going on and inflation and a whole host of different things, but I am excited about the trend and the macro dynamic of what's going on.
Amazing. Awesome, my man. Well, we did an hour here. Truly, truly appreciate
it. I appreciate you guys inviting me. I'm probably a little over caffeinated, probably a little bit too jacked up. You probably caught I was a little jealous of John's hair gel, so I did need somebody to tell me where I can buy that.
You might have just got out of the water. We're here in Southern California. I don't know. Were you surfing out there this morning or?
No, but I'm going to say my wife bought me the gel. I have no idea what it is. I'm going to send you a link.
It's looking good. You're doing more with less. That should be the tagline on the hair gel. Doing more with less. Okay. All right, guys. Thank you. Have an awesome weekend.
Thank you, Anthony. Appreciate it. Thanks, everyone, for listening out there. And John, as always. And my man, we'll chat with you just quickly backstage. Thank you so much.